Good evening and welcome. My name is Pretty Burdett, and with the World AI Run LSE Cities, which is one of the research and teaching programs here at the school. I'm also a professor of urban studies. So for those of you not part of the LSE or LSE Cities, you realize we're interested in cities. And it's one part of the LSE that now for 15 and more years has been looking at the interactions between the physical world, the social world, and the political world. And now that we have a new senior visiting fellow, Rowan Silva, we're also beginning to understand the relationship between cities as innovation, technology, and many other aspects. It's a special evening tonight, not only because it's the first time that we have Rowan speaking in his capacity as senior visiting fellow at our centre, but also because it is part of our Executive Masters in Cities Teaching Week. We have here, sitting in the front rows, 24 experts from around the world in different disciplines who are spending a week with us, and this is also part of the didactic and intellectual exchange between really those who make decisions in cities and those who are very active in terms of the interface and what's happening on the front line. Now, Rowan is a really particular case, and it's just interesting to see how many people are here, Rowan, interested in hearing what you have to say, because Rowan was very involved up until a few years ago in hardcore politics, come to that, and decided to put his money where his mouth was. If he's going to be someone, as he was, advising government, he was a senior policy advisor to Prime Minister David Cameron on many areas of enterprise, but particularly innovation. He then decided after that, for a number of years, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, and I'm going to go and do enterprise. Those of you who've been to a part of East London just off Brick Lane and seen an extraordinarily glowing yellow building, four stories now, and soon to be have a neighbor, a new neighbor, glowing yellow, fantastic lighting, lots of exciting things happening, very, very good food, and lots of startup companies with people from different disciplines talking to each other. It's one of, and I have to say now, one of Rowan and his partner Sam's second homes. Second home is something I'm sure you will talk about in a moment, is literally an innovation hub where which nests individuals and young organizations, startups, which are interested in exactly the sort of creativity and innovation, which is what makes cities what they are. And London has had to reinvent itself in many ways as a center of innovation in the technology and other areas, even though it's sort of more traditionally known as you know, the classic center of insurance and classic financial services. We'll hear undoubtedly tonight that actually the profile of London's economy is changing very much because of some of the ideas and policies that have been pushed across government over the years. One final thing. Philip and I have been running at LSE City something called the Urban Age. The Urban Age is an international series of conferences which happens every year or so, and a number of years ago, 2012 in fact it was, we held an event in London which was about really exploring the notions of the smart city, innovation. We called it the Electric City Conference, and we held it in Hoxton. And we got to, I got to meet you, Rowan, maybe 2 or 3 months before to see whether maybe the government might be interested in somehow taking part in this international exchange and all that. And this was happening on a Thursday, on a Friday and a Saturday. On Wednesday, I get a phone call from Rowan and says, Rowan, do you mind having a chat? So, is it okay if I bring a couple of people to your conference? Well, actually, the Prime Minister would like to come. But he'll be accompanied by the mayor, is that okay? So, it was the most extraordinary event because in many ways we couldn't tell anyone because of security and everything else, so we had to wait for the two individuals who actually came at 9:05 together. They never talked to each other. We, of course, now know why, given what's happened in terms of Brexit. But it was just one of stuff happens when you have at the center of these sort of networks institutions, people who are interested in sort of connecting. And I think there's no one better than Rowan to talk about the scene of governance, innovation, technology, and literally, as the title says, are they connected? Because without these three sort of layers working together, not much will happen. So it's a fantastic pleasure to have Rowan here. The format of the evening is he'll speak with some slides for about 30 minutes or so, and then we'll have it just open Q&A. When we come to that, for those who are not at the LSE, there's a very, very simple rule here at the LSE. Say who you are, and don't go on for a long time. you're not allowed to go on for a long time. If there's a question, ask it. Don't give the answer yourself. That's not why we're here. If there's a comment, that's fine. You may disagree with something that has been said or that something is missing. But please identify yourself, keep it short, so we can have as much conversation and dialogue as possible. So on behalf of the Executive Masters and all the participants, on behalf of LSE Cities and everything else, welcome Rowan Silver.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction. And hi, everyone. Thanks for being here this evening. I spent a year at the LSE when I was a bit younger. I was a terrible student. I never used to come to any lectures or anything like that. And it's weird. Now I've left, I'm here all the time. I think that is because, what Ricky and Philip and everyone here at the LSE have done so brilliantly is create an environment that is truly open. And whether you're technically part of it or not, or whether you're bunking off and you should be studying or not, this is a place where people come together. And my experience in government is that there's no institution better than the LSE at talking to policymakers, which is incredibly needed, especially given the politicians don't often talk to each other, let alone to people in academia. This kind of agenda is incredibly important. So it's a real pleasure to be here. And what I'd love to talk to you about this evening, as Ricky says, is the relationship between policy, national and local, and this wonderful entity, the city, and where change comes from in the city. So essentially I'm going to talk in sort of a game of two halves. I'm going to talk first about national and urban policy, secondly about how change can also emerge in the city in a bottom-up way, which hopefully should cover a lot of what all of you are working on thinking about. As Ricky says, I spent many years working in government. This is me having a very awkward hug with my leading guy. I'm not sure he'd given many hugs before. So. But I also worked at the University of George Osborne, who was Chancellor, before that, the Shadow Chancellor. So I spent many years, I'm now trying to earn an honest living as an entrepreneur, away from all of that. But when I was in government, and actually out of government, there were a couple of trends, a couple of changes happening in the world that I was really fixated on. And I think it's important, in my view, in thinking about city and urban policy, to be cognizant of these shifts, which I'm sure you are. The first shift, it was predicted by this man, Gordon Moore, 50 years ago. Gordon Moore was an engineer working in Silicon Valley. And he had a sort of ringside seat seeing the innovation taking place. And 50 years ago, he made a very bold prediction. His prediction was that the computing power, the amount of number of transistors you could fit on a certain size of circuit board, would double every 2 years. Now, this is a pretty bold prediction. Not many things keep doubling in the world. And the remarkable thing is that, I think as we all know, Gordon Moore's prediction was so unerringly correct, it's not known as a prediction at all. It's known as Moore's Law. And because of that doubling, that exponential increase in computing power that drives on and on and on, we hear very sort of, there are things that we're used to hearing, right? We're used to hearing, well, the computer that's, computers used by NASA to put people on the moon, are thousands of times, less powerful than the phone in your pocket. Thousands and thousands of times less powerful than the phone in your pocket. I mean, that's one way of thinking about it. It's slightly abstract. Another way of thinking about this shift in technology and growth in technology is that in 2 years' time, the advance in computing and the increasing computing power will be bigger than the increase, will be bigger than the total increase in computing power since the dawn of the digital age. So this shift, Moore's Law, is so profound. Make the consequences for economies, societies, political systems are so big in a sense that they're quite hard to grapple with. But I'll come back to how I think we can find a way forward through this turbulence and change caused by technological revolution we're living through. The second shift that I think is really worth dwelling on is related to technology. And it really is to do with the question of where jobs come from in developed economies. And if you look at the OECD data, the one thing is really clear. 6% of high-growth small businesses generate over 60% of all the new jobs in developed economies. This is true in Britain, it's true in America, it's true in France, Portugal, etc. And, you know, this is in large part because of technology, because the cost of starting a business, scaling it, reaching a global market, has come right down because of technology. And I think understanding these shifts and trying to grapple with them, interact with them, and enable more people to benefit as a result of these changes, I think is one of the central challenges of our generation. How do we sort of move forward in this world? How do we make sure it's manageable, prosperous possible? Well, I happen to think that cities are absolutely key to this. And when I think about cities, I think about a paradox. And the paradox is this. We can all, thanks to technology, work with anyone, anywhere, very easily. We could all be sat at home right now, dialing in via Skype or Google Hangout. We can all be talking to each other via WhatsApp and Slack and all the rest. And yet, that's not what we're doing tonight. We're physically located in a room. And it's not what happens globally. If you look at where innovations emerge, where that 6% of high-growth SMEs are being started and growing, it's happening in dense urban areas. So in spite of technology, in a sense, obliterating distance, proximity matters more than ever. If you look at where patents are being generated today, they're more strongly, there's a greater correlation between patent creation in dense urban centres today than was the case 30 years ago before the dawn of the internet. So there is something very paradoxical, I would say very beautiful, happening. And this importance of a cluster in job creation, technological change, is clear. You obviously see that when you look around the world. Most obviously Silicon Valley and San Francisco, but also Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv and Israel more broadly is home to 6 million people in Israel, a small country, and yet has produced more technology companies that are on the NASDAQ stock exchange in New York than any other country except for America and China. So there is something special that is happening in certain parts of the world. In San Francisco, Silicon Valley more broadly, places like Tel Aviv, leads to a disproportionate quantum of jobs, of innovations. And I think, I always felt in government, the big question for us was, how do we get some of that here? And I'm sure for those of you from cities around the world, this is key question. And the optimistic thing, the hopeful thing I'm going to say to you tonight, is that the insights that can lead to successful cluster formation and growth can work anywhere. And to begin that journey of understanding how, I think it's worth, especially as we're here at the LSE, starting with a little bit of theory. And there are three academics that I think between them really illuminate and provide a kind of pathway to successful cluster formation and growth. The first is Richard Florida, Which is going to be here at the LSE, I think.
On Monday, the 9th of October.
Well, that's so hopefully he will be here for that, because he's definitely going to listen to. Richard Florida, as I'm sure you know, coined the phrase, he's an American academic, coined the term creative class. And he wrote a book called The Rise of the Creative Class 10, 15 years ago. And really what Richard did before anyone else was understand that 6% of high-growth businesses, the people that were most successfully responding to technology change, was this group we call the creative class. And they have, like all other cohorts, certain characteristics. There's certain places they want to be and places they don't want to be. They really like places with a particular urban fabric, old buildings. They really like art galleries, cafes, music, live music and so on. I mean, they're just like all of you and all of us. But that kind of prism through which to think about cities, the creative side of cities, is not typically the way policymakers tend to think. I think of London, which I'll come to later, think of how many of our music venues are closed and so on. It's clear that the sort of Richard Florida agenda is not one that is still, I think, central to the way urban leaders generally think about clusters and what that is. But if you think about East London in particular, there's lots of bits of East London very, very attractive to this global creative class. This is Kingsland Road in East London. And when I was reading Florida for the first time, I was living in East London, and it was clear that there were the ingredients there for something to happen that would be hugely attractive to the global creative class, because the building blocks were there. The second theorist, obviously, worth celebrating and thinking about and reflecting on, is Jane Jacobs. Jane Jacobs, works like The Rise of the Life and Death of Great American Cities, really makes the case for human-scale, diverse neighbourhoods, neighbourhoods with a sort of fractal complexity, that is very, very different to the kind of corporate developments that are happening in a lot of cities, but are absolutely key if you want to be attracting and speaking to the kind of creative class, the kind of entrepreneurs that start those companies that create the majority of jobs and prosper in the tech space. When I was reading Jane Jacobs for the first time, I was living in East London, and it's clear that places like Brick Lane and many other streets in East London are sort of Jane Jacobs' wet dream, if it's okay to use that term around. Someone as saintly as Jane Jacobs. The work of these theorists mapped pretty nicely onto some of the things that I saw in East London. And the third academic, the third and final academic I think worth thinking about as we chart a path forward, think about clusters and policy, is Ed Glaser from Harvard. Now, Ed takes quite a different view to Richard Florida and Jane Jacobs. He really emphasises infrastructure, transport links, broadband connectivity, having low crime rates and so on. Quite a sort of utilitarian way of thinking about the city, quite more traditional. But I would argue that a successful approach to thinking about clusters and cities embraces all three. It's not a question of a silver bullet. Clusters, towns, cities are messy, complex, path-dependent sort of organisms. There isn't sort of a one-size-fits-all. So I think thinking about those three really is instructive. And I certainly did when I started this initiative called Tech City. Now, I was looking like a bit of a plonker in India. We went to India with the Prime Minister, David Cameron, in 2010. It was our first big foreign trip. And we took over a bunch of sort of startup entrepreneurs. And one of them was a guy called MacWeb. And MacWeb ran a company called Burn. And on the last night in India, he came up to me and said, there's something really interesting happening with tech in East London.
I was living in East London. I think I sort of pretended, yeah, I know that. But I didn't actually know there was this digital cluster emerging. And at the time in 2010, there were about 200 digital technology companies starting to bubble up in East London because the fabric of the streets felt right. Richard Florida, Jane Jacobs' nurse of that part of town were very strong. Like, naturally, these creative people were congregating there. We think we're about 200. It's quite hard to measure. Sometimes you worry you're measuring a counting a kebab shop or a website, but we think there are about 200 digital companies in the area. But what that said, and when I went and spent time with these entrepreneurs, it was clear that this cluster wasn't really working properly. And there were three challenges that the community posed. The first challenge was that no one knew this cluster existed. Global investors, big companies, etc., didn't know this cluster existed. And that's a problem, because you really want investment, you really want more companies going in and so on if the cluster's going to grow. Challenge one. Challenge two, the cluster was very fragmented. So there were a couple of hundred companies, but there weren't really places, spaces, opportunities for them to come together. So the cluster was much less tight-knit and synergistic than it could have been. Third challenge really related to government policy. Head lasers are infrastructure in a sense. Real shortage of startup investment, challenges around immigration, challenges selling into government, getting government contracts. So there were challenges even as this cluster was beginning to emerge. And it became clear to me that actually government could do something about this. In line with Jane Jacobs and Ed Glaser and Richard Florida, there was something we could do to really support the growth of this cluster. And so the cluster was emerging really around Old Street Roundabout, known by some as Silicon Roundabout. And so I created an initiative. The game was called Tech City. And we launched it in November 2010. And we set out to address these issues raised by the community and so unlock the full potential of this cluster. And so have as many as those companies, that 6%, that vital 6% of companies creating the majority of jobs, have as many of them happening here as well. And so the first thing I did was try and address this issue of there not being a space for entrepreneurs to come together. So I had a meeting, went into Silicon Valley, and was lucky enough to have a meeting with Eric Schmidt, who was then CEO of Google. And I started pitching him on East London, and he stopped me after a few minutes of me blathering on. And he said, no, listen, we don't put our people in a business park in the middle of nowhere. He was clearly used to schmucks like me from governments around the world trying to pitch Google on some zany scheme. And what I said to Eric Schmidt, which was true at the time, was actually there was 100 art galleries within walking distance of Old Street Roundabout. There were fewer today, but there were in 2010. And that was genuinely the thing that made him take this area seriously. I don't think he was reading Richard Florida's work, but he intuitively knew that Google could never put their people, have their staff somewhere that was a kind of cultural desert. So that got his attention, which is good. And Google being a slightly mad company, the conversation quickly got out of control. Eric then said, okay, all right, we'll do something in East London. He goes, all right, how about we buy the Olympic Park? He said, how much? And I have with me a good friend of Ricky's, a guy called Andy Altman, who was in charge of the Olympic Park legacy company. And poor Andy, brilliant guy, has obviously never been asked the question, how much do you want the Olympic Park? And so sort of mummed and ahed and didn't really have an answer. And so the conversation moved on. And what we ended up shaking hands on was Google creating an innovation hub in East London, a place for the community to come together. And that's what got created. This is a bit of a crap photo because actually if you go there, it's full of thousands of people. But the Google campus was what was built. And the Google campus, I don't know if any of you have been, but it's a 5-6 story building just by Old Street Roundabout.
that has two Google employees in the whole building. The rest is given over to startup incubation spaces, a ground floor event space that's free for the community to use, and then in the basement, a sort of 19th century coffee shop that is full every minute of the day, people pitching and trying to find investment and hustling. It's amazing. And this became the sort of beating heart of the cluster. And, you know, it goes to show the importance of proximity and clustering, but the tangible importance of something as simple as, okay, what is the front door into that cluster? Where do I go if I want to get involved? Google Campus became that and really catalyzed the growth of the community. So that was addressing, or helped starting to address, challenge one. No places, not enough places for the community to come together. The second challenge was, well, no one's heard of this cluster. No one takes it seriously. That's quite easy, actually, for government to do. It's cheap as well, because we're lucky in Britain. You can wheel out the royals. I'm not sure you had any idea what was going on. But you can get the Royal Family out. You can use the honours system, as we did, to give honours to entrepreneurs and people in that cluster, so suddenly the establishment started taking them seriously. We invited them all to number 10, so again, using these sort of assets that states have, all governments, all cities have these iconic assets that are free to use. If you direct them in the right way, very cheap tool of public policy. And out of that, banging the drum, came, you know, investment from new buildings and teams put into East London from all these companies. And it was cool, because when we started the Tech City Initiative, really no global companies in East London. There was no Google, there was no Amazon, no Microsoft, etc., no Airbnb, etc. And they were all there within 2 years, 3 years. And the reason that it was so easy, and the reason that this can happen in so many other cities, is that, of course, the corporations understand, consciously or not, the importance of proximity. They want to be close to the effervescent startups, those 6% of high-growth companies. They want to invest in them, they want to steal from them, they want to learn from them. They definitely don't want to get disrupted by them. And as Mike Tyson, the great sage of urban policy, once said, everyone's got a strategy, Mike Tyson said, until they get a punch in the nose. And these big corporations are getting punched in the nose by the startups. They want to be close to them. So you can really get them to invest in clusters as long as they can see that's where the startups are. So that was the sort of second challenge. The third challenge that was set out by the local entrepreneurs and people in the cluster was to do with infrastructure at a policy level. And there's a very deep relationship, as Ricky said, and as all of you know, between urban policy, built environment, and wider public policy. And the challenges, you know, that the people working in this cluster expounded were partly physical, you know, not enough places to come together, but were also policy related. Challenges to do with the immigration system, challenges to do with the tax system, and so on. And it's really important, I think, if you're going to have a successful cluster policy, to think about both ends of the telescope, if possible. So we did a whole set of things. We created entrepreneur visas so that talented people from around the world could come to the UK and start businesses, particularly in Tech City. We created entrepreneur relief so that entrepreneurs could keep more of the money they generate. We created tax breaks for angel investment to unlock lots of startup cash, which is so vital. We made changes to the intellectual property system to support digital innovation and so on. So it was we did a whole set of things. We created a program called Entrepreneur First, which we launched now with number 10, to encourage more graduates to maybe not go and work for Goldman Sachs or McKinsey or go to the civil service, as I did, but instead start a business. Anyway, did a whole set of things. And you know, this is all absolutely related to insights derived from the cluster and also designed to support this cluster growth as well as, you know, the growth across the rest of the country. And the impact was pretty profound. So 200 or so
digital companies and kebab shops with websites in 2010. By 2013, there were 2,500. Today, 10,000 digital technology companies in East London. And you know, that growth, that sort of exponential uptick, you know, is really sort of the power of clusters, that paradox of proximity that I set out at the start. And you know, the cluster like East London is the sort of cluster, it's even around the world, where Moore's Law, the emerging growth of technology, isn't so much a threat as an opportunity, and that 6% of high growth companies are disproportionately based in places like this. And in my view, I think it's possible, if you have enough clusters doing the right things, to actually increase that percentage from 6% to 8%, to 10% and so on, and have more of the jobs that you know, all societies need. So this is what we did in East London through the Texas Initiative. I left government a few years ago, and clearly with Brexit, etc., government's a lot on its mind. But I think urban policy, and certainly public policy, is a bit like the scene in Alice in Wonderland, where the Red Queen, Alice comes across the Red Queen, and the Red Queen is sprinting, but the background behind her, the environment around her, is moving as well. She's running incredibly fast, just to stand still. And I think, you know, anything to do with innovation, technology, entrepreneurship is a bit like that. But run really fast, just to stand still. And the proof of that is if you look at what other cities are doing. So within a year or two of us launching the Texas Initiative, Berlin, Paris, various cities have launched similar initiatives with, you know, different levels of success. But I think you're now seeing some really impressive catching up being done. And indeed, in some cases, moving ahead of London. So Lisbon, a city I know very well, the socialist government came to power under Camilo António Costa recently. Their manifesto for government, the first page of their manifesto for government, includes the tax breaks for individual investments, the entrepreneur relief, and the entrepreneur visas that we had created just a few years before, which gave London a sort of decisive advantage. They're now in place in Portugal. Fair play to them, doing very well. In New York, the previous mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, did something incredibly visionary. He understood that clusters require people and talent. And on an island in New York that was sitting derelict, he launched a competition for universities around the world to pitch, to create a new computer science and engineering technology campus. That competition was won by Cornell and an Israeli university. And it's going to be churning out thousands of impressive computer science graduates and engineers each year, which will be a real step change for New York versus London and everywhere else. And then finally, the final example of other cities really racing ahead is in Paris, and well, doing very impressive things. And this actually is not an example of national policy or even mayoral policy. A tech entrepreneur called Xavier Niel in Paris has started a few different institutions, and one of them, one I think is worth really celebrating and looking at, is called Ecole 42. Now, Ecole 42, has anyone here sort of been there or no, this place? Ecole 42, set up by Xavier Niel. And what it is, it's a computer science college, campus, that's entirely free. So anyone can go there, anytime, and sign up for a course. It might be an evening, it might be a week, it might be a year, and it's totally free. And, you know, as a catalyst for social mobility, and more deeply, a catalyst for cluster growth and urban innovation, this is incredible. Because none of this works without people and talent. And so, you know, Lisbon, New York, and Paris, three great examples of cities and places really playing catch-up, in some cases moving beyond London. And interestingly, in Lisbon, it was the national government that drove the change. In New York, it was a mayor. And in in Paris. It was a crazy entrepreneur operating pretty solo. So change can come from anywhere. But I would say this is a really challenging moment for London, particularly if you think about why the backdrop of change is not just as though we're standing still in London. I would argue, in various ways, we're at risk of heading in the wrong direction. Obviously, there's Brexit, and what could happen, and I think what is on course to happen, with regards to immigration, and a Prime Minister determined to make it harder for talented entrepreneurial people to come to London. I think that's obviously not good news. If you think about the prism of Jane Jacobs and Richard Florida, as I mentioned at the start, and think about London through that prism, well, the kind of soulless corporate developments you see across the city are really terrible if you're trying to attract the global creative class and you're trying to create environments where innovation can really happen. This is Nine Elms, down by Battersea, but there are many, many more examples of terrible things happening in our city that are very, very bad in terms of innovation in general. Thinking about Ed Glaser's work and infrastructure, well, London has amongst the worst broadband infrastructure of any major developed city. It is terrible. There are central parts of London, Soho, Westminster, and so on, that are complete fibre broadband black holes. But wherever you are, including in East London, the broadband infrastructure in London is clearly not fit for purpose and markedly poorer than other major cities, as I say. And also, you know, from a Richard Florida point of view, thinking about the creative life of the city, the places that make the city attractive. Well, 40% of London's music venues have closed in the last 8 years alone. 40%. And, you know, it's actually accelerating. Just this week, we got word that the last remaining late music venue in northwest London, in Kildon, is being forced to close down by Brent Council. And, you know, this really speaks to, my view, an ignorance of the true economic impact and cost of the clamping down on cultural spaces, LGBT venues, music venues, in real cost in terms of innovation. I was doing an event in Lisbon, and it was about 1 a.m, and the mayor of Lisbon was still at this event, having a few drinks. And he 1 a.m, he said, "Listen, I'm really sorry, I've got to go. I'm sorry, I'm leaving so early." He was saying, "Exactly, it's 1 a.m. And he said, no, I've got to go. I've got another event to go to." He said, "How on earth are you going at 1 a.m? He said, "Well, I'm going to go and open the night." And, you know, again, whether consciously or not, whether he'd read Richard Florida or not, I think he probably had, there was an awareness in other cities of the importance of these kinds of institutions, which in London we still see as a nuisance, as an issue to do with noise, public safety, rather than something that makes the city worth living in for mobile, creative, global workers that could, frankly, be anywhere. the question of, you know, clearly it is possible for government to make a difference on these issues, for civic leadership, for national leadership to make a difference. I'm not wildly hopeful about the next sort of few years, frankly, when it comes to government policy. I hope I'm wrong. I'd love to be wrong. But yeah, it's not really on the agenda. I think that's a shame because this is an agenda about jobs, it's an agenda about growth. It's not just an agenda about cities. So if there's a challenge for London when it comes to national policy, where might hope and optimism come from? Well, I think the wonderful thing about cities, as the LSE shows and many other institutions show, change comes from the bottom up as well as the top down. And the Tech City Initiative, successful as it was of course a response to an organic bottom-up growth of a cluster that had nothing to do with government. We sort of got behind it and tried to support it, but we didn't start it. And there are many, many great things that can happen in London that have very little to do with government. And the example I'd like to talk about, if it's okay, is something I started when I left Number 10. And I used to get my mitts on a derelict carpet factory just off Brick Lane, a very Jane Jacobsy part of town, very rich and Florida part of town. And we my co-founder Sam Arbenton, we decided to appoint a set of really radical architects. At the time, they were architects in residence at MIT in Boston. And the reason they were at MIT is their work is very influenced by evolutionary psychology and biophilia, and very obvious insight, of course, that we didn't evolve in environments that look much like our buildings and cities. We evolved in places full of complexity and seasonality and natural light and colour and so on. But it was a bit of a punt because the architecture practice, the Sagas Cana, had never designed a project outside of Spain. And we wanted to build a second home in 14 weeks, so that was going to be a challenge. But these are all buildings that they've done. This is in Cartagena in Spain, and the auditorium they created. This is their studio. And what we wanted to create with them is a cluster within a building. That was the hope. Could we extrapolate from Tech City work, could we extrapolate from the theorists that we admired, and create a cluster within a building, and so support the emergence of like 6% of high-growth small businesses? Could we do that? And here's what they designed for us: an environment that was incredibly fluid, that featured a space for cultural events where the community could come together, as well as private spaces for teams to kind of focus and grow, as well as collide with others. And here's what it looks like, a second home. And inside this building are 150 different teams. Public sector, private sector, companies big and small, and global and local. Because that's what clusters have. You know, there's a beauty to the diversity, even within a cluster that's centered on a specific area. The economy. Second home, we really believe that innovation comes at the intersect of different fields. And so inside Second Home, you've got fashion companies next to virtual reality filmmakers. You've got big corporations like Ernst & Young and Volkswagen next to help refugees. It's a great mix. And our job, we see there, is not just to kind of choose that mix and create the space, it's to stir the pot. And so we have a team of community organisers who are constantly going around saying, hey, have you met this person over here? And you must go and you must have a coffee with these people. The methodology we have, because we get to control the building much more than you can control a city, we have a methodology that's pretty clear and very scalable. 20% of the people, teams at Second Home, we've chosen because they do things that growing organisations, that 6% of growing organisations, that these companies do things that those growing organisations need. That might be venture capital, it might be legal services, it might be recruiting, branding, design, so on. Because that means that as you're growing your organisation, you'll find everything you need within that cluster, within the community. That's why clusters are so great. And it's proven to work very well. And the nicest thing is that we found that teams at Second Home grow on average 10 times faster than the national average. And so, for example, there's a company called Bulb that started at Second Home 2 years ago. It's a green energy company. Two young guys from London started this company, two of them, 2 years ago. There's now 80 of them based out of Second Home. And we see that kind of growth all the time. That's a lot of new jobs being created. As I say, that interplay between the corporates, just like in Tech City, getting the Googles and the Microsofts, I always saw as the key to the growth of the early stage companies. And it's the same here. Because, of course, if you're a little company, you can do business with the big ones. And that's absolutely vital for growth. And also, if you think about it, if you have a cluster or a building that's just starting, there's a limited extent to which they can learn from each other. There's definitely a limited extent to which they can do business with each other. So that diversity is very important. And so we get to be kind of dictators within our buildings and shape it very carefully. We have Malala, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, had a foundation at Second Home, mentioned help refugees. So it's a really broad mix.
It's a bit small, but you see here the breadth of industries. Apologies for the tiny font, but you know, the social impact and not-for-profit is the biggest category. Then it's fashion, environmental sustainability is one of the big ones. And what's lovely, when I talk about that 6% of high-growth businesses, organisations, they don't come from a specific sector. It's not like they're just tech companies or just creative industries. Any company can fall into that category if it has the right environment. And that means lots of jobs in different categories, which I think is very important from a social point of view. In the centre of Second Home is a table that weighs 1.5 tonnes. You can sort of see it through that void. And throughout the week, it gets lifted up on motorised pulleys, creating a sort of auditorium space for people's yoga. You can actually sort of see me up at the top. I don't do yoga. And you know, we host events there throughout the week that are free and open to the public. And we've had people like Richard Branson, Lord Martin Rees, and the Astronomer Royal. Richard Rogers, who was here recently, Danny Boyle, the filmmaker, spoke in Second Home, Stella McCartney, Edward O. Wilson, the great Harvard biologist, and so on. So, and that is really important to us. You know, a cluster, a successful cluster, has to include places that people can come together. It's why we have the great restaurant that's open to the public. And I would say all of you thinking about cluster policy, the question of where is it you can actually come together, whether you're invited or not, whether you've got a pass or not, where are you free to go in and mix, I think is absolutely essential. Off the back of Second Home in East London, we were invited by the Portuguese government to come and explore Lisbon, and we were very excited to apply these insights from these three academics, as well as the lessons from Tech City, and from Second Home to Lisbon. And we found a site in Lisbon on top of the oldest fruit and veg market in the city. If you look up on the first floor there, that is Second Home. And so we decided to create a Second Home there. And it's proven to be, again, very lucky, a real catalyst for the creative economy. So in this space, you've got Mercedes next to a new surf school for Lisbon, and Vice magazine Portugal next to some guys trying to bring food delivery to Lisbon, which doesn't really exist there yet. So an incredibly broad mix of industries. There's some real cross-pollination between fields as a result. And again, the ambition is to create a cluster within the building, and we use this space here, essentially where the photographer is standing. Is a space where we host live music and talks and so on. We've got a lending library in there as well. So, what this goes to show is that change in Portugal, the government's doing really all the right things when it comes to national policy, but change still also needs to come from below, which I hope we've contributed to some of the way. The PM and the mayor standing in the centre there, who goes out to 2 in the morning opening nightclubs in the centre of industry, going to open Second Home, which I think says something about their understanding of bottom-up change, as well as the great work they're doing at national level. Last few things to show you, and I'd love to open up to questions and conversation. In order to help bring our street to life, when we opened Second Home in East London, about a third of the shops on the street were boarded up. And we thought that was a shame. We thought it was possible for life to come back to the streets. We did something very stupid. We opened a bookshop, which no good entrepreneur would ever do, I think. But we worked with our partners to create this environment. And again, it's another venue where the community can come together. The central console there all folds away, and the stairs down the basement get covered over. So it becomes a really vibrant venue for live music. Police don't shut us down for films and various events. And the bookshop itself, I won't go into too much detail, but it's been designed in a way to try and maximise serendipity. The kind of serendipity that happens in clusters. We've designed the shelves and organised the shelves so that you're really likely to come across books that you wouldn't have come across before. That's what we're trying to do. And that, of course, is what cities do at their best.
As Jane Jacobs put it so beautifully, the great public wealth of our cities comes from a small change of random interactions on the sidewalk. And you know, we are trying in this picture to sort of add to those random interactions. The last thing I just want to show you is a project we did in Nairobi last year. So Second Home funded this project. This is Kibera, biggest urban slum in Africa, and with our architects and a group, our architects and others wanted to build a new school, building an existing school in Kibera, and so we funded this project. And I think what's really important is that if you do believe that ambitious architecture and an approach to community and curation can make a difference in London and Lisbon, we have to believe it can make a difference in places like Kibera. And the headmaster of the school certainly says that the pupils are doing even better than before now the school is there, and they're actually getting, it's become a real beacon of pride in the local neighbourhood that the school exists. So that's something about what we're doing. We've got a new project coming up in London where we're sort of acting a bit like a sort of local mayor, in that one of the real challenges in London at a policy level is to get access to childcare. It's not really what I'm here to talk about, but I can happily talk about it in Q&A, but we're creating a new second home in East London with a real emphasis on providing access to childcare, creating a family-friendly environment. So this workspace will also contain... Oops. Not a laser. It will contain a creche. And it'll actually be the first creche in the UK with a 50-50 male-female staff ratio. And we've had lots of fun with the architects thinking about how you design a space with children as well as parents in mind. So all the flooring is made out of recycled car tyres. I'm very clumsy, so that's very good for me. There's going to be scooter parking for kids as well as bike parking for adults and so on. And I think it's fundamentally a job for the mayor and politicians to be able to be creating childcare, accessible childcare, affordable childcare in the city. But if they're not doing it, then bottom-up change, hopefully, can be a bit of a catalyst for that conversation and to show what's possible. So that's what we're doing. I'm open February next year. I want to end by returning to one of the three academics that I think, certainly for me, has informed how I think about clusters, urban innovation, and entrepreneurship. Ed Glaser said in his book, Triumph of the City, that the city is our greatest invention. And he said that because, as he pointed out, almost every other innovation and invention of the last 500 years has emerged out of the city. And what gives me great hope, even at times where public policy maybe isn't pointing in the right direction, the city can still metabolise innovations that improve urban life. And so I just want to say to you, whatever you're doing, I know you're working on really interesting things, whether you're in government or want to be, or whether you're working in business or other aspects of the public sector, change in the city can come from anywhere. And I hope I've shown that in a small way. And I hope I've also shown, because I really believe, that this kind of urban innovation isn't exclusive to places like London. It really can happen with the right willpower, the right action, the right framing of theory. It can happen anywhere. So, but hopefully, as I hope I'm going to spend. Thank you.
Someone once told you that no Nobel Prize or major innovation prize was won by someone working outside the city or working in a village, which is you showed that extraordinary project in Lisbon, and you talked right at the beginning of the importance of what governments can do. It seems to me one of the things that governments can do is reduce regulation to allow the sort of messiness and organic sort of quality. So what is it that Lisbon, for example, that you talked about, the mayor actually, you know, it was just one phrase you used. What, give us an absolute concrete, what was the policy initiative, who decided it, and why did it make a difference to you going there?
So the current Prime Minister of Portugal, António Costa, was previously the mayor of Lisbon, and he did a set of things that were really well. I think the two that I think are worth particularly celebrating. The first is that there were a lot of empty buildings in Lisbon, and a lot of very tough historic rules about how these buildings should be used. You know, some for good reason, but I mean, you know, it would take 3, 5, 10 years just to get a project moving. And he set out a very clear, very specific sort of policy change, which meant that a derelict building was treated differently to an existing building. And that someone who wanted to invest in and bring to life a derelict building had an incredibly streamlined pathway to permission. And the default was that he created, and it was a cultural change in the thing. The default was yes when it came to investment and change. And that just swept through the city. And if you go to places like Beato in one extreme, or LX Factory in another extreme of Lisbon, you see these immense derelict spaces full of life. And our building, the second home is in, was a derelict, close to derelict. The space we were in was totally derelict. The last use I could find anyone to talk about was 20 years ago, some ballroom dancing classes in the space. But that commission, that streamlined regulatory approval process, was incredibly powerful. The second thing he did that was very effective was he created participatory budgets for the city. And that led to really impressive bottom-up innovation. And the best example of that, so participatory budget, i.e. lump of money, you, the public, choose how it should be spent. I mean, it's your money. Of course you should have a big say in that. And but the great example of the good that came was a project called Startup Lisboa. Startup Lisboa was funded through this participatory budget. The public wanted it. It was a popular project. They took over some derelict buildings, made possible because of the regulatory changes, and they created a startup incubator. So the startups could be there for free, they got mentoring, support, a little bit of money, and this just blew up. And these two quite simple changes just created an entrepreneurial culture and a gender in that city that's intoxicated. And, you know, Second Home is there. We took a decision to be there 3 years ago. Lisbon's now talked about, I think, as kind of, you know, one of the great emerging creative cities of Europe. That wasn't the case 3 years ago when we decided to go. It certainly wasn't 8 years ago when António Costa started making that change. But this snowball effect can happen very quickly. And those two regulatory changes, policy changes, were the catalyst.
And you made a very important point about how within Second Home, within the cluster, and this happens elsewhere, not just at Second Home, the dialogue between different groups who wouldn't normally be talking to each other actually has ended up sponsoring, promoting some form of creativity, but also increasing productivity.
Right.
Those statistics.
Yeah.
But that requires someone with the nervous energy and curatorship, effectively, of going there and making sort of those connections. And, you know, I think that's all to do with proximity. I was curious whether now that you've, year plus, that you've had the Lisbon Symposium, are there intra-city
huge.
Yeah. Does the Lisbon Second Home gang connect to the London, where you have 3 second homes in London?
Not quite.
Nearly, 2.5.
Yeah. So, one of the nicest things, one of the things we hoped would happen, was that we'd start to see relationships between teams based in Second Home in London and teams based in Lisbon. And that is really happening. Lots of the London teams are working with graphic designers out of Lisbon. We're constantly having over Lisbon entrepreneurs coming to pitch to the investors based in the London community. And, you know, I think the lovely thing about, you know, clusters working together, people working within clusters, is that, you know, as the old sort of parable says, you know, talents are distributed unequally, and it's through trade and exchange that we sort of perfect one another. And, you know, Lisbon is great, really creative, but there's no capital there. London has loads of capital, but, you know, it can be expensive to hire a graphic designer or get a website built and so on. So there's a really deep interplay, not through altruism or, you know, empty networking, but genuinely because both sides gain out of that exchange. It's been immense, actually. And pretty much every day second in London, there are Lisbon founders and people working, and vice versa.
Let's have some questions. If you put your hand up and you'll get a microphone. So start at the back there, and then in there with the glasses. We have another microphone, Marianne? Okay, tell us who you are quickly.
Hi, I'm Phil. I'm not an expert in this area at all. My technical language isn't great. But what do you say to the idea that bringing clusters together, like you say in places like East London, because of the fabric that's there, of these buildings and the culture, actually bringing these cultures, bringing these clusters together, destroys the diversity that made them attractive in the first place, by way of gentrification, upping price, and forcing the people out, and the things that made it attractive as a place to put these ideas there, destroys them.
Mm. Well, this is a an absolutely central preoccupation, or ought to be, for anyone who's thinking about cities. Now, change is inherent to cities. Right? So take Brick Lane, the heart of East London. 30 years ago, a group of conservatives who didn't want Bangladeshis moving into Brick Lane. The park at the bottom of Brick Lane is named after a poor young Bangladeshi man who was beaten to death by conservatives who didn't want Bangladeshi moving in. Today, the conservatism is, well, we don't want the Bangladeshis to leave. And actually, if you talk to the people who run so there's a flux that's healthy in cities. Change, to hold the city in aspic, is not a good thing. Now, the real challenge, as you say, is people being priced out. Artists, residents, and so on. This is where urban policy has to play a role. So one of the things we tried to do with Second Home, for example, down in Peckham in South London, we had a proposal to create 800 artist studios in a derelict car park in Peckham. And these studios would have been £200 a month, so incredibly cheap, and a quarter of them would have been free. And we were working with sponsors to make it happen. So the local council turned that down in favour of like a retail park thing. And so there is a, you know, ultimately, there's a huge stewardship role. It's not inevitable that jobs and growth is a bad thing, as long as there are enough houses being built to keep pace, the people that won't be able to afford, that currently struggle and will continue to struggle, are properly supported, artists, people on low incomes, and so on. This is a role for public policy. And it's not something London has got right at all. An agenda that I think is really important are a type of housing called community land trusts, which is a form of affordable housing where the land, where the houses are permanently affordable, and the cost of the flat is pegged to local incomes. You know, projects or initiatives like that could make a big difference, but they're just not currently, sadly, part of the conversation.
The key point here is that any such innovation, any such sort of shift in the economy of a city needs to be supported, backed up by wider social policies, a la housing issue, which of course is at least as an attempt that's being addressed by the current mayor in terms of building, for the first time ever in the last 20 years, just affordable housing on land owned by the city itself. But that's a wider issue, but a very important one.
Yeah, in the same vein, actually. My name is Francesca Kaluk. I work for the LLDC, so I work on the Olympic Legacy Project, and I work in economic development. So I do a lot of what we've talked about, and thank you for hitting the nail on the head in a lot of ways. My key issue, I think, with what's been said so far tonight is that the context in which stuff has happened in East London sits amongst incredibly deprived and disadvantaged communities. I mean, some of the poorest in the country. And by virtue of the fact that Shoreditch had the absorption capacity for this cluster to emerge does not mean that that is resulting in real social mobility for local people that live there. And I think that there's a real issue, and I think it's an issue that we're looking at citywide level, about how you open up the job market to disadvantaged groups, ethnic minorities, local people on low incomes, etc.
Sentiment that I really agree with, that's always resonated with me, that the ancient Jewish philosopher Maimonides once wrote that the highest form of charity is to create a job. Now, I don't think there's anything particularly great about areas where there's sort of static poverty and high levels of joblessness. And I think initiatives that are well thought through that create jobs are very good. With Tech City, we did a few things that I didn't talk about. We created a program called Tech City Apprenticeships with Hackney Community College. And we also had a very aggressive living wage agenda through Tech City project. And, you know, that's proven to be, I think, a really great gateway. Now, the challenge is that, you know, if high-paid jobs have been created, which is a good thing, not everyone has the ability to get those jobs. That's a role for training and again for government policy, which has to be, you know, well funded and ambitious in its scope. But it's also worth saying that the sort of the knock on effects of, let's say, a tech company opening an office in terms of local businesses is immense. If you go down Hanby Street, where Second Home is, and talk to any of the curry houses and cafes and so on in the area, that footfall is immensely important to them. And so I think it's easy for us often in urban policy to wind up stuck, because if you end up thinking that jobs being created and investment going in causes problems, which is not what you're saying, I know, but is easily the way the debate can get framed, you end up sort of doing nothing. And you have a very strong reason not to do anything, because the political consequences can be pretty severe.
Let's have two questions in a row. You and you.
Thank you. I'm Manilo from UCL. You spoke about Xavier Dni, who has also started another initiative called Station F.
Yeah.
Which is this mega project that happens to be an incubation center. Would you recommend that every major city invest in such a project, or get the billionaires and the elite class to invest in a huge, a mega sort of incubation center?
I was wondering, what do you make of the, I'm Rob, I'm an entrepreneur from Helsinki, which prides itself as one of the Silicon Valley's, yeah, 20 of them of Europe, I think, and counting. What do you make of the recent discussion that technology might actually be destroying more jobs than it's creating? Like the Moore's Law has done to such extent that computers learn.
Yeah.
And it can take like 20 years before you can start replacing it.
Yeah.
Great question. Should we take both of those questions?
Yeah. Well, I think this question of, you know, should every city invest in or twist the arms of billionaires to invest in incubation space and so on? I think that there clearly can be a catalyst if done in the right way. I think what all cities and all clusters are different. They're path dependent. One of the things I was always on guard against in government when I was there were people saying, let's build a Silicon Valley in London, because, of course, Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley. London has specific strengths. So I think, you know, ultimately, there's no shortcut to being grounded in a bit of theory, pounding the streets, talking to entrepreneurs, and trying to figure out, you know, through the prism of theory and perhaps what's worked elsewhere to an extent, work out what's really needed there. But I would say there's lots of cities where creating a big incubation space would just create a white elephant. You know, unless there's the channels through which people can train, unless there's means by which people access capital to start businesses, you'll just create a big empty big empty space, which is probably a bit of a shame. On Helsinki and
on whether AI might be actually destroying more jobs than it's creating.
Sorry,
at middle income jobs especially, and that's
very positive.
It's clear that, to me anyway, that technology is really affecting the labour market, and lots of jobs are disappearing and changing. If you look in the UK, for example, fully half of all secretarial jobs have disappeared over the last 10 years. There's never been a march, they're not unionised, there's no fight, but those are jobs that are disappearing. Something bank tellers, people working in bank branches, again, is quite a scary place, unfortunately, to be in the economy. The good news is that lots of new jobs have been created. You know, Britain is has the highest levels of employment it's ever had. But the real role for government, I think, is that the new jobs that have been created aren't the same as the old ones. And government has to invest in training in order to bridge that gap. I think one of the things that's really depressing about Britain, it's true in America as well, is that if you lose your job, let's say you're a 50-year-old truck driver, you lose your job because the truck starts to drive itself, which may well be the case within about a decade. Right now, we expect you to borrow money and go into debt in order to retrain. And I don't think that's a fair settlement in this 21st century unpredictable economy. I think
so what about?
Well, in my view, government should not only pay for your training, you should also get a salary while you train. But then take us away at the end of training to create an incentive to get back into work. That I think is a kind of generous, ambitious agenda for government. It's something that only really central government can pull off.
Gentlemen, over there with a hat.
Yes, I'm Dr. Keith Postler, former guest lecturer in statistics and finance at LSE, where I did my PhD. The government has gone in for HS2 and building a rail link to link the north and the south, with the idea that this will help the north. Do you think it will rather help the London and cluster and improve London at the expense of the north? Or is there some kind of hub between Leeds, Manchester, and Newcastle?
Yeah.
I suggested you know you were going to have transport.
Great.
Go ahead.
It's a tough one to predict. As the physicist Niels Bohr said, prediction's often difficult, especially about the future. But if I had to guess, which is all it would be, I'm not trying to...
Well, I asked for a comment.
Yeah, I would assume that HS2 will be of huge benefit to Manchester, Birmingham, in time, Glasgow, Edinburgh and so on. Because, right now, working across cities and getting to other cities takes longer than it ought to. Wi-Fi is patchy on trains and so on. It is a real inhibitor to cluster growth. One that I spent a bit of time in government unsuccessfully trying to do something about was better linkages between Tech City and East London near Liverpool Street and Cambridge. There are lots of trains between Liverpool Street and Cambridge, as people might know. They're generally incredibly slow local trains that take a couple of hours. Actually, some more direct trains between these two clusters would be a huge catalyst. And I believe that very strongly, and so I would assume and hope, my hypothesis would be that the likes of Birmingham and Manchester would benefit. So will London from that train.
And as ever, these issues are not isolated. You can't just put in a high-speed rail line without thinking about other issues such as housing policy. And it's interesting that the discussion about connections east-west across the north are beginning to surface again. In fact, George Osborne's original idea, which may complement and avoid some of the problems that might inevitably
happen.
Yes. Hi, my name is Francis. I'm a software engineer. A question more linked to do with the education, actually. Do you see any correlation between the density of universities or education institutes and the successful of this cluster? That's the first point. The second point is, I don't need to repeat the number of successful startup which their founders dropped out of uni. So my question is, would it be encouraging for students which probably don't do well in their uni to use their student loans to get into entrepreneurship? Is it something that is encouraging or that will be helpful, you know, in this case?
Encourage all the users to think about this. But we set up a thing called Startup Loans when we were in government, which was modeled on student loans, exactly the same sort of format and payback kind of rate. In order that you're starting out, you can get your business going, also have some mentoring and support and so on. Whether you went to university or not, you can access cheap government cash, which is quite cool. So you have to blow your student loan. Instead, on sort of relationship between universities and clusters, it's interesting. Tech City cluster grew up in an area really without a major university. Queen Mary's is sort of at the fringes of Tech City. I think it depends. It definitely can help if the university is open and porous. British universities don't tend to be really. I think they're quite sort of inward looking. They're not very good at working.
Except for
the LSE. So it's a given. Sadly, there is a bit of a structural challenge with a lot of lesser British universities. I think the talent, I think, in the broader sense, really matters. Whether that is through apprenticeships, through places like the Pole 42, if you don't have talent, you're going to struggle. And the challenge for Britain, London, is that post-Brexit, we've got a government committed to reducing that flow of global talent. So unless we can do something about that, we'll radically increase homegrown skills. We're definitely facing that difficult times.
Yes. One question there and then here.
Hi. First of all, thank you. It's very interesting, presentation. So I really like the ingredients.
Tell us who you are, please.
So I'm Marwan. So I really like the ingredients of what makes a cluster. But I think one of the things maybe is just creating, having an innovation-friendly market. That there's a lot of really early adopters. There's a culture and consumers that like change, and it's easy to market and sell your products. The other thing is we talked about a lot of initiatives the government did to encourage innovations. But from what you said, all of it is around good governance and establishing a good environment to live in. So maybe there's some examples where governments try to invest a lot of money and try to make policies to encourage innovation that had the opposite effect as well.
Yeah.
That might be, you might know. So.
Yeah, oh yeah. I think that's right. I think that the policies that worked best in the UK were ones that, as you say, were about creating a framework, and more often than not about sort of supporting the kind of distributed intelligence or investment decisions of thousands of people. So tax breaks for angel investment. Angel investors are people that decide to invest in a startup, like the Dragons on Dragon's Den. Creating tax breaks for them, for that kind of category of investment, was really interesting because it unlocked a lot of that investment. But the government didn't decide what companies were invested, people decided. And that was really effective. What worries me about some other countries, and we chose not to do this, is I think where government creates investment funds and tries to invest in startups. It's totally possible. It's just really, really, really
hard. But is there one concrete example which hasn't worked?
Well, so the stuff in Britain that really worked badly and continues to work badly is a bit of the British government that is very well funded called Innovate UK. Innovate UK, we doubled its budget.
Anyone here from
Innovate? I mean, it was our biggest cock up. We doubled its budget and we wanted it to create sort of innovation centers. In Germany, they're called Fraunhofer Institutes. They end up being called here catapults. And they've just proven to be a total waste of money because the organization that set them up is so poor. And the truth, that stuff is really hard. If government's going to actually create innovation spaces on itself, you've got to be, you know, Xavier Niel in Paris is really good at this stuff. And there are lots of government institutions or quasi-government institutions around the world that are good at this. The Israeli Office of the Chief Scientist, the Stanford Research Institutes, the MIT Media Lab and so on. DARPA, US military, very good. It's just very hard. Britain actually is not very good at that kind of innovation policy.
Last two questions here.
This actually piggybacks off the question you just mentioned. I'm a behind. I'm my Lang, I'm a bureaucrat from California, from the States. And my question is about what are the opportunities that you see and limitations of working in government and trying to instill innovation? And sort of related to that, when to enter government and when to leave government.
I'm so in awe of, you know, I love government. I really loved every minute of working genuinely in government. And, you know, I think the constraints are often there for good reason, except when they're not. And I think that the stuff that I worked in government that I didn't talk about here that I really enjoyed was to do with trying to have government itself use technology more effectively. So we copied a bunch of stuff that President Obama was doing around open data and making government more transparent and so on. That stuff where you actually get into the wiring of government and turn it inside out is huge, because suddenly you start to release government data, people can build apps off the back of it, people can build companies. And I think anyone in government, the constraints, which is, you know, government doesn't have a lot of money, actually can be a great driver for innovation. And I think particularly when it comes to things like government data and getting that open, opening up government procurement. When we got into government in 2010, 70% of government IT contracts went to just 7 companies. And by the time I left, we'd been able to get up to 60% of IT companies going to SMEs. And that was no difference in amount of spend. It's just money going to real innovators and startups. So I think the constraint of there being no money, which is sort of true in most governments, I think is a massive driver of it. Should be a huge driver of innovation.
Yes. Last
question. Hey, my name is Mark. I work for Tink Labs, which is a startup tech company based in Hong Kong. So my question is, we are actually the first unicorn enterprise out of Hong Kong, which is a little bit surprising, considering that Hong Kong is a major commercial center. It is to Asia as London is to Europe. So what do you think might be missing in Hong Kong? Do you think like the factors that you mentioned earlier, is that at all regional specific?
No, well, I would say, you know, it's a great question. Those three sort of academics that I mentioned was kind of, you know, helpful, I think, when thinking about clusters. Hong Kong, obviously, scores well on my Ed Glaser index. The infrastructure's good, you know, it's a safe place, and so on. As long as you don't venture too far to Kowloon, it's pretty safe. But on the kind of Jane Jacobsiness and the Richard Florida-ness, Hong Kong, maybe less so. You know, if you are a young artist, a young musician, and so on, Hong Kong is a difficult place. And for certain reasons that London is becoming a difficult place. Hong Kong is very expensive. The big corporate developments in Hong Kong aren't really the kind of places that sort of created. It doesn't have a lot in common with Brooklyn or Soma in San Francisco. And so I think that is the challenge, a bit like for, say, Canary Wharf in London. How do you create, if the creative economy is becoming much more important, the tech economy, how do we make sure the built environment and the cultural life of the city is attractive to that category of worker? Hong Kong is very attractive to an expat working in financial services. It's brilliant for that, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's an impressive thing. Lots of cities would like to be. The strategic question, I think, of Hong Kong is, do you also want to be attractive to this global creative class? If so, it would mean quite a different urban fabric, at least in some part of the city.
be a cool challenge.
And what's an interesting issue behind, you know, say these two cities, is that what is tending to also happen is as there is more and more global investment, we had Saskia Sassen speak to the class today, you're getting a form of gigantism of built form, which sort of obliterates the ferocity, the messiness.
Absolutely.
So there's that other process, and therefore sometimes planning regulation or deregulation, actually not enforcing certain things, becomes just as important as trying to enforce many things. Now, I can see there are 20 other hands up, so you'll just have to come and speak to Rowan here when we finish and say thank you. You mentioned right at the beginning three significant words: proximity, investment, and effectively patronage through the government, which I think is a very important concept for us to think about when it comes to issues of our technology, innovation, and governments actually hooked up. And the notion of proximity is more than just spatial proximity, but actually you've made such a strong case of being together in many ways, being close to each other, eye-to-eye contact is important, and the environment within which that happens. And I guess your second home images are very, very clear about that. I want to end in a moment and hope that you will join me in thanking Rowan, but there is one question. Who authors the plans?
Not me.
Not artificial intelligence.
I wish. No, we play hydroponics. Any other time around hydroponics.
So this is the code. But I think in the end, you say not me, but the curator of literally all these things, and I mean this also at policy level, at government level. The mayor is also a curator of the city, and and I think one of the things that we've been able to put very clearly in front of us, with a lot of passion, I have to say, which is fantastic, is the importance of that role. So, will you all, in a moment, join me in thanking Rowan? I have an appointment, of course, with Sunny Khan at 1 o'clock. and then Theresa.